There's my belt on. Okay, welcome everybody. We are continuing our board meeting and we're going to discuss a series of papers on contaminants.
Yes, thank you. That is September and the October meetings. You've made decisions, or tentative decisions, to improve the responsiveness of the general model and to make some clarifications and improvements to certain aspects of that model. So this month, we will focus more on specific aspects of the proposed model. At this stage, we are still not asking for a decision as to whether you want to proceed with the finalization of the ED. We will ask that question at a future meeting, so we're carrying on the assumption that we will finalize the ED. Similar to the discussions we've had in previous meetings, the staff recommendations in this set of papers are just clarifications and improvements to the proposal, so we're not recommending any fundamental changes to the proposed model. I'll start with agenda paper 5A. This paper discusses the feedback received on the proposed requirements to estimate expected credit losses on loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts that are within the scope of the exposure draft. And in particular, this paper focuses on whether there's a particular type of loan commitment for which expected credit losses should be estimated over a period that extends beyond the contractual notification period, and if so, what that period should be and what discount rate should be applied to those instruments. In the feedback received on the exposure draft, the majority of the respondents agreed with including loan commitments and financial guarantee contracts in the scope of the proposals, and we're not recommending making any changes to the scope or presentation requirements. However, many of those that responded noted that expected credit losses should be estimated over the behavioral life rather than the contractual life of the loan commitment. And this was of a particular concern for revolving credit facilities such as credit cards and overdraft facilities. Respondents argued that estimating expected credit losses over the behavioral life is more consistent with how those exposures are being managed and it more faithfully represents their exposure to credit risk. In general, the staff still consider the contractual period over which the entity is committed to provide the credit as the correct conceptual outcome. However, we believe that for revolving credit facilities, the contractual ability to demand payment and to cancel the undrawn commitment does not necessarily limit the entity's exposure to credit risk just to that contractual period. And we also question whether relevant and useful information will be provided to the users of financial statements about the entity's exposure to credit risk and how the entity has managed those instruments. So if you wish to reconsider the proposal, taking into account the economic situation and the conceptual matters, and thus look beyond the contractual life, we recommend that the behavioral life should represent the period over which the entity is exposed to credit risk and that faithfully reflect the economics of the transaction. We also recommend that for revolving credit facilities, the discount rate to be applied should be the EAR that the entity is applying for the drawn balance or the financial asset facility. And with that, I will hand over to you for discussion.
Amaru? Thanks for this topic. I am very sensitive to the issue you brought. I think in practical terms, this is reflective of the real life in financial entities, particularly when they have the revolving facilities that they keep running for, in some cases, 30 years, 40 years. I have a personal experience on that. So I think it's very sensitive, very reasonable what you are proposing. I just have one question here. If we decided to treat differently those revolving facilities that you are characterizing here, how do you envisage we are going to do that in terms of the general model? And are you, do you intend to use the concept of commercial substance as drafted right now in the conceptual framework to characterize this, as you said, I would say, inability, practical inability to simply withdraw the facility?
Yes, I don't think we've really made the decision as to how we would include this guidance in the final standard, but I think there are a number of ways in which it can be done. So it could either be just application guidance, or it could be in, you know, if you want to do it in the way of an exception, or if you want to incorporate this as the overall principle. So I think that's for, it depends on what you decide today to do with it.
My preference would be an overall principle, but would this be implemented consistently and correctly as we intend it then? Or do you have any preference among these three that you expressed, considering the outreach that you are having and exploring with stakeholders that brought this to our attention, of course?
I think the only concern we really have is that we don't really want this to become too widespread. So
Perfect.
We know it is applicable to these particular facilities, but we don't want people to apply this guidance to any other kind of loan commitments that they are rolling over on a continuous basis and repricing the instruments.
Yeah.
So we want to limit it as far as possible just to this group of facilities.
Daryl?
Building a little bit on what Amaro was getting at, I think I agree with where the staff have got to on revolving credit. I think that there is the, and I think Amaro used the word, there's a practical inability for the bank to withdraw the facility before the credit event happens.
Mm.
Because until they've identified who the bad loans are, the only way that they could do it is to withdraw the facility. So I think the behavioral life is the appropriate way to go with this. I'm comfortable that that makes sense, and I'm comfortable it correctly reflects the economics. I am concerned that we're trying to draw a line between loan commitments and revolving credit, because I think sometimes those two types of exposures work the same way or work in very similar ways. And examples will be facilities like budget facilities on credit cards, which act like you draw down to purchase something and then pay it off over a period of time, or loan commitments with drawdowns, with discretionary drawdowns on them. So I would be more inclined to go for a principal type model, approach for that, which I think Amaro was getting at, where you would say that where the bank lacks the practical ability, or the entity lacks the practical ability to withdraw the facility before such time as a credit event has happened. To my mind, in that circumstance, the behavioral is a more appropriate than the contractual. So that would be the first point that I think, to my mind, I wouldn't try to distinguish between the two types of loan commitments. The second element for me is EIR. I think, and I battled to figure out in this one, which was the exception and which was the principle. We've agreed on primarily on loans that we will use EIR as the focus point, and EIR at origination. We then said for revolving loans we will do the same, and that's because of the inability to distinguish the cash flows. But on loan commitments we said we'll use a different rate. So it seems to me that's the exception. I would have preferred to see us use EIR there, and again it's because I see the similarities in the economic concepts between the two. A loan commitment can also have, as I say, amounts drawn down and amounts not yet drawn down. So you have the same issue of which cash flows. So I would prefer to say we just have a common process across all of them, which is that you use EIR for everything. I understand that it might be that we've done it in loan commitments because we're concerned about the practicality of establishing what the EIR was. But I haven't yet seen a loan commitment that didn't have all of that built into it, what the rate was that's going to be charged, what the term of the rate was, what the charges were that were associated with it. So it seems to me most of the information is available there. So that's kind of the main things I'd make. The one additional point, the caveat that I said at the beginning, is about presentation. And I am concerned that we said from a presentation perspective that although we say up front we're going for the same EIR because the interest rates, because it's difficult to determine the different cash flows, when it comes to presentation, suddenly we seem to think it's okay to determine the different cash flows. And I think if the principle is it's too hard to determine the cash flows, that should flow through to the presentation too. That maybe means that in order to solve the problem of having a credit without an associated debit, we might want a first in, first out principle or something like that. But I don't think we can leave the presentation out there if we said that the cash flows are the problem. Sorry, that was a very long...
On that last point though, Rihanna, people were less concerned about that, weren't they? They felt they could do an allocation to... Yes. So they weren't so concerned, because I asked Rihanna the same question because it surprised me.
It just seems that the artificiality that we were concerned about resolving with the EIR discussion, we seem to be not as much concerned here. And it results in some sort of balance sheet gross-up. Now, simply saying a first in, first out to me is much easier. In other words, you take a provision against the asset until the time there's no asset left, and then revert. That's practically easy, and at least everybody would do it consistently.
I think the reason a lot of people mentioned the fact that the reason they want to use one discount rate is because they manage these facilities on a facility level, so they don't distinguish between the drawn and the undrawn balance when they manage the expenses. They calculate the expected credit losses using the same rates in their systems. And so if they have to split it for presentation purposes, they would have to make some kind of allocation. Some of them have more sophisticated ways in making that allocation. Others have said they will apply what you've described first in, first out, to put everything to the asset and what is left to the undrawn bit. But the reason they were supportive of putting it for presentation purposes was because they said they could see conceptually that a part of this relates to something that's not on the balance sheet yet. And they could see the reasons for presenting that separate as a provision.
My question was the same on the last point. And it just seemed odd to me. Have this thing out, so I'd basically support the first in, first out.
Maybe we could give that as a simplification if they couldn't do it in a more scientific way.
Doug?
Yes. I'm wondering whether there is a chance to use IAS 37. Of course, in the first line of 37, it says it's out of scope for the financial instrument. So any liability resulting from financial instruments. However, the issue we are talking about is the contingency, which may happen over the contractual term. So it totally depends on the behavior of the customer. So then, I don't think it's really the liability resulting directly from the financial instrument. This could be treated as a separate liability, which you have to make a provision anyway. It's not the loss allowance. So if it's a provision, I think there might be a chance for us to use IAS 37. So if that is the case, then we don't have to discuss it within the impairment of financial instruments. Rather, we could just state you have to assess IAS 37 in the case of revolving loans, or in the case of there is a high chance, highly likely that customer may extend a loan commitment, whatever. If we could include such things in the basis for conclusion, then constituents can go to IAS 37. So. I was wondering whether if there is any chance.
And maybe she can fill me in here where I'm missing something, but I think during the progress of this project, we've been told consistently by preparers that they manage the credit risk on the undrawn facilities or on loan commitments, so the off-balance sheet exposures, in exactly the same way that they are managing the on-balance sheet exposures.
Yeah.
So, and I think that was one of the main reasons we decided to bring this into this standard, so that we have one impairment model that applies to everything that's been managed from a credit risk perspective in the same way, rather than making an arbitrary accounting distinction if that's not the way how they are being managed.
I think further than that, even as we just talked about presentation, very often the two pieces are part and parcel. So there's an on-balance sheet and an off-balance sheet that are managed and looked at exactly the same way. So it would be odd to treat the on-balance sheet one way with a provision determined one way and the off-balance sheet potentially a different way.
Stephen?
I essentially agree with your recommendations, including the number two. So I have a concern over this term behavioural life. I find it rather imprecise. If I have an outstanding credit balance and I'm paying it off and drawing it down, paying it off, and it never goes to zero, I'm not quite sure how I interpret it. So I felt that what Daryl said about drawdowns that cannot be realistically avoided, or that there should be some other way of explaining it, perhaps that's more precise. However, I do have a couple of concerns. One is, I think you need to look at this in the context of stage one and stage two. In stage one, I think clearly you need to think about the drawdowns over the next 12 months, because if you're doing the 12-month allowance, you can't avoid it because, well, there's been no deterioration, so why would you withdraw the facility? In stage two, if you're doing a collective assessment, again, you don't really have a realistic way of withdrawing the facilities. You don't know which of a particular portfolio has yet deteriorated. But if you have stage two and you've done an individual assessment, well, now you do have an opportunity to withdraw it because you can see it's deteriorated and you can now make the decision whether you withdraw or not. So looking forward to future drawdowns, even though you've made the decision not to withdraw it, seems odd. And I would have thought that the general recommendation of only looking at what you're committed to provide would kind of make more sense under those circumstances. So I'm happy to extend it to situations where future drawdowns cannot be realistically avoided, but not to go beyond that, which I think is what you're getting at, but I have this confusion over what behavioural life really means.
Yeah, perhaps we could give some application guidance in terms of when you're making the assessment using Daryl's words, which I won't try and remember exactly, that you need to take into account the sort of status of the facility, like try and bring into account those considerations about what's going on with the particular obligors as a form of guidance. I think we're trying to capture what you mean, but to make it clear.
Martin.
Yeah, I wanted to echo what Daryl and Amaro have already said, because I think we should not limit it to these credit facilities. We should be more principle-based. If also for other credit products we have similar circumstances, that should apply in this behavioralized stuff. And secondly, I think, okay, that was the discussion, if we should show that also undrawn commitment as a liability, I think we should give more choice to prepare, saying, okay, maybe you should do it on the asset side as a deduction and then first in, first out, or you can do it as provision but disclose it. I think it is not a big issue, which we should really give clear rules. And thirdly, I had a question, because now this behavioralized is then for both. It is for stage one and stage two.
Yes.
Okay.
And the reason for that is because you're looking at the facility as a whole, you are still looking at, you know, the behavioural life over which you can suffer expected losses on that facility. Now, if you have decided to pull in the undrawn, so you decide to limit the undrawn bit, you still have, you know, your facility is now just smaller, but you still have the same issue about you can suffer the expected losses on that balance that you have over a behavioural period.
And I ask you the question, because if it is already in stage two, isn't it a kind of where the bank should have it closely monitored and then maybe are in the position to look at it in more detail, and if it has really problems, okay, if the risk is too high, that it can cut really the line. And do I...
Daryl?
I think that's a valid comment, but not entirely. The first one is, as Stephen referred to, portfolios. So if you have any portfolio, you actually have something in stage two, but you haven't identified the individuals within that portfolio. I think also, to an extent, the significant deterioration criteria is not necessarily always going to be an actionable criteria. Mm-hmm. It might be a decline in the credit quality, which means you more closely observe a particular client. But that doesn't necessarily signal that you can just go in and withdraw the clients or withdraw the client's facility at that stage. It simply might mean that you're observing the client at a closer basis to see what further comes out of it. I think for most of the, certainly the bank that I was involved in, withdrawing a client's facility is something that you only do if you're sure that there is an increase in credit. And the fact that we set this slightly earlier now, we want an earlier trigger in the model, that's the intent of the model. It means that there might be times when that is not an actionable deterioration in credit. And without trying to play on my words and thinking they're going to be the solution for everything, I think if we can word it right, that point, we're trying to capture the point at which, or the point before which there is a practical ability to action. That means we will capture that point
before
the problem ever happens.
I support everything that's been said today with respect to where we may go here with accounting for what would be deemed to be, I guess, the present contractual obligation, music and behavioral approach. I always thought that that was something we should consider when we first voted on this. So I have no objection to that. What I have given some cause for thought, though, is about this last recommendation that Daryl has put on the table, and that is effectively to net what is a liability against an asset for presentation purposes, if I understand essentially what you're recommending, Daryl. And I think that is not necessarily going to provide as much information about the relationship that, for example, an entity may have to a large corporate customer where, you know, the size of these kind of committed revolving credit facilities are quite large. I'm not so worried about the retail customers, but the large corporate customer base, I think you would be, I think, taking a lot of useful information off the balance sheet, be putting in the notes, you'd have to go look for it. I'm not sure it's great presentation. It kind of smacks of a little bit of cute accounting or presentation in my mind. I'm not even sure there's a right of offset, you know, there that you could specifically, I guess, point to. So I think we need to give some thought to that issue.
Mary? I wanted to express support for the idea of the, I'll call it practical accommodation for the revolving credit. Been going back and forth about this. I think it's a conceptual compromise for the reasons that's laid out in the paper in terms of you are making a provision for an asset that doesn't exist yet. And I think rather than trying to tie ourselves in knots to justify, and there is the analysis in here about whether you have a conceptual, commercial substance to the right to cancel, I think we just say, based on everything we've heard, particularly for revolvers, they just are managed as one. And given the overall objective of the expected credit loss, we decided that we should not make people split them artificially. And therefore, even though it compromises this notion, just acknowledge it and say that's what we did. I have some concern with it growing in this discussion today to extend beyond the revolvers, which were the focus, I think, of most of the feedback, to the other lines of credit, particularly when you're starting to get into the kind of thing Pat was just talking about now in the offset. He was talking about in connection with offset, but if you have very substantial committed lines of credit that you do have an ability to cancel, it's the argument that I have no practical ability to monitor those separately just sends up a few more flags. So rather than us rushing today to just sweep those in, I think we might want to ask the staff on those, extending it beyond the revolvers, which is the focus of the paper, to go back again and look at the feedback and see if it was as consistent about the practical difficulties and how comfortable we are about this line. And then I think the other thing we need to be clear about is whether we are saying this is it, this is the conclusion we're reaching for everybody with respect to whatever the population is, and let's say it's revolvers, or if we say subject to you not having the ability to manage them separately, which we assume all revolvers are meet, because I think then if we say it's subject to, I think we'll get a much greater range and then we'll have issues I fear that more, actually, because I think it would require disclosure about, in my situation, in these parts of the business, I have the ability to, in these parts I don't. And you'll have to read, you know, a lot more to understand where somebody's drawing the line, as opposed to saying there's overwhelming feedback that revolving lines of credit virtually nowhere, you know, especially for retail customers, then separately, therefore, would compromise if we said X. Mm-hmm. Assuming that we go ahead, and let me just focus on revolvers, I think if we're going to do it under expected credit loss, we should do the whole thing. We shouldn't try even to do a reasonable allocation in at the end in terms of how do you split it between drawn and undrawn. If we limit it to the retail, then if somebody starts having debit balances credit balances in that area, that's maybe a flag that they're expecting. They aren't managing their credit in a way that they expect to allow people to draw down amounts that they're going to make a lot of future losses.
I don't think that's true, though, because the model looks at shortfalls and cash flows and doesn't look at the revenue side of it, I don't think it reflects necessarily sort of bad practice as such. It just can mean that you've got a lot of potential exposure because there's lots of people to draw down.
But rather than trying to avoid the intellectual anomaly of having a credit balance, because the loss allowance on the anticipated drawdowns, is bigger than the current balances, I'd say don't try and split it. Just tell somebody to explain it if they have that situation, because I think any kind of allocation, whether it's FIFO or capping it at the amount of the asset, is just a calculated number. And if we're going to treat this, because they're managing the whole thing together, just do it and don't try and dress it up as something different. So support behavioral, though, take Stephen's comments back. Can we clarify what we mean by that? Not sure we should just rip that to extend it beyond the revolvers. And think we have to be clear, and I'm leaning towards just saying it's a decision that everybody has to apply, even if they say, well, I'm the exceptional institution that can manage my revolvers, the drawdown separate from the drawn down separate from the line of credit. I think we just make a decision for this category.
I just wanted to challenge Pat's characterization of the assets and liability in this case, because we're talking about right and set off as though they are a separate asset and a separate liability. And I think what you're trying to address, I think, here is the fact that the extent to which you expect that the cash that you've advanced will not be returned to you. So it's not a separate liability so much as a asset that you're not going to get back, unless you actually have, over and above the expectation of the cash that you're not going to go get back, you have further cash that you'll have to advance. And I think the concern for me when I picked up on this one is that it's very difficult for me to tell which is the cash that I'm not going to get back, the cash that I've already advanced or the cash that I'm still going to advance. And it feels to me that any kind of split like that is totally artificial. So I don't think it's a right of set-off so much, because I don't think the right of set-off comes into it in that the liability in this circumstance, or the provision in this circumstance, is simply a provision against an asset that I've either advanced or an asset that I'm going to advance.
I guess I would disagree that you don't have discrete assets and discrete liabilities. I think you're treating this as a fungible pool of cash with essentially as part of one contractual pool of rights and obligations. And that clearly is, I don't think, the case. There's clearly different economic rights and obligations associated with a loan I've made and a line of credit. That's why there's typically separate legal agreements.
I think, and I just want to confirm this off here, I think we're talking about single facilities.
Yeah.
So a revolving facility is where I have an advance under that facility and undrawn capacity under the same facility. A loan commitment where I've had some drawdowns on that facility and some undrawn, so So I think we're talking about single contractual relationships as opposed to using one loan to be offset by a different loan. Mm-hmm.
But they're different rights and obligations.
No,
they
not.
May be governed by the same contract, but they're different rights and obligations. They have different terms. I used to read them every day for almost 5 years, and while they may be in the same legal document, there are different terms associated with them.
Even if you have, let's say, a $2 million commitment and you've drawn down $500,000 of it, the other million and a half that you haven't taken yet?
No, I'm talking about the loan that you've made versus the committed revolver, or in the case of a committed line of credit, those two things may be subject to the same legal agreement, but in my mind, they're different assets and liabilities.
PK?
Yes, because I was getting confused with this discussion a little bit, and want to ask a question. If I give a loan to somebody, a bank, for a change, I give a loan to somebody and I also give him a revolving line of credit. The loan has been drawn down, or the money has been given, and he has the line of credit that he can draw anytime. Now, because it's managed in the same pool, I thought you're going to take care of that, draw down and look at the behavioral or whatever it is to do it. But I'm hearing that, no, there's a two different loans, so we will not do it. Is that, I'm slightly confused with this question.
It's more like what Mary was describing.
Yes. We what said there was no asset behind the...
I'm not talking about presentation.
It's more like what Mary was describing, I think, is what we're talking about. I've got the ability to go to my bank and ask for up to $2 million under this facility. So far, I've taken out $500,000, and I've got another $1.5 million of capacity to draw on at the time that I want it. And I might go back and repay some, so now I've got $300,000 outstanding, and then the next day I'll go back and draw some more down. So it's
I got that.
Instrument.
What about if there are two? What do we do?
I have a loan and I have a committed line of credit separately. Yeah. We're talking about the combined one, like Mary was describing.
When they're part of one agreement.
So, but do I need to make an ECL for that, for the undrawn line of credit or not? That's the question I'm trying to ask.
Yes.
My answer is yes.
In both cases.
Huh? Both the cases you should do it.
But in one case, I'm treating the two as one instruments separately, and in the other case, like Mary's case, it's a single instrument that's got different capacity over time.
And what is the difference between the two? In terms of the estimation of the credit loss, I would say I would follow the same logic. In the $2 million Mary's case, where $500,000 is drawn down, and another case, which is my case, I gave a $1 million loan to Gail, and he has a line of credit of $2 million.
I think the case where it was complicated, which I think is what Rhianna's focusing on, is where I've got this, more like a credit card, where I've got up to an X amount, and I use some, pay it back, so it's very...
I got that. No, I'm asking, what do I do in this second situation? What is there anything different that I should think about?
I think we are assuming in the second situation that you have the ability to cancel or restrict drawdowns under the $2 million separate line.
But if you have the ability to cancel, that it doesn't even get into the equation. If you don't have the ability, that's what we are talking, practical inability to cancel it. I would say it's the same logic.
If it's just a loan commitment, like a letter of credit, or you've given someone the commitment, you will give them a loan at a certain interest rate and advance for a certain period of time, and you've got that loan commitment, you will estimate your expected credit losses over the contractual period of that loan commitment. All we are talking about is where you've got a revolving credit where the contractual period isn't really making sense, and that's where you have to use the behavioral line.
So this behavioral aspect, you're going to bring it to only to situation where, in the Mary's example, $2 million of which half is drawn, you can pay down, bring it back, and all that stuff.
That is what.
But that's
our
different from Amaro, Daryl, and Martinez thing.
Yes.
Recommend, right?
So some want to broaden it to all loan commitments. The staff recommendation in the paper is to limit it to only revolving credit.
And to revolving credit only for that particular thing, not if there is a river.
It's always only the individual contract that you're looking at.
Yes.
And the only point I think that I was trying to make anyway is that I think that the principle that you're trying to address here is those circumstances where you can't practically withdraw the facility. And that to me is equally applicable to some loan commitments and to revolving. So rather than identify the category revolving loans, I would prefer to identify the principle, those circumstances where it's practically impossible to withdraw the facility.
I agreed with that. That's why when Mary brought it up, there was no response from you guys, so I was not clear where you're going with that, because I agree with that, because with what Daryl and Martin have raised, because that makes sense. Why do you want to complicate to say, look at the behavioral only if it's for an existing line, if it's something else, do contractually, it becomes very complicated. And behavioral works for everybody.
I think we were reacting to the fact that the original board decision was based on this contractual notion and the conceptual framework, so we were trying to stay as true to that as we could, while dealing with the most significant practical challenges which were raised in the context of the boulders. So we were trying to balance those two competing forces.
But once you made an exception to principle and the conceptual framework, you might want to use it logically to the whole thing, where it applies. That's what I'm trying to say. It doesn't make sense to you made an exception. You made an exception sensibly to across the board.
And what I'm objecting to is the presentation.
That's fine. I got that. You got it wrong in terms of if I have a $2 million loan and $500,000 is drawn down.
And a million on one side, and a potential liability.
It's the same thing for me, isn't it? It's the same thing.
Heard the conclusion debate, what do we conclude?
Actually asking if they want to limit it to revolver or whether they want to broaden it.
Yeah. As somebody who had a concern on that, I hate drawing it out, but I'm not, the paper focused on the feedback we've had about the revolvers. I'm not sure from this feedback in this paper whether or not I agree with Daryl's argument about let's create a principle, because I'm not sure how much we've heard about other categories. And I'd hate to just say no now and find out later it was a problem, but I'd also hate to say yes now and find we've created a huge range of practice with lots of people serving different abilities and have it vary widely across types of institutions.
Could we agree that we agree with the staff on the revolving credit one, and that they go and have a look at the other ones and see where it's a
separate extender.
Yeah.
Make it in December.
Agreed?
What's for next Wednesday to do that?
Okay.
That revolver, does that?
So should we vote on the revolver?
Yes.
There's a staff recommendation subject to us bringing back some analysis on whether there's a broader issue and whether we should extend it based on a principle rather than limiting it to the revolver.
Well, it's an agreement on the revolver, and then you'll
we need a vote on that.
Yeah.
13. Can't wait.
Agree with Tom.
Seven.
The discount rate, the second question.
Second question on the
discount rate.
Yeah.
And I said that long term.
I'm not sure what I'm agreeing to for loan commitments on that one.
I'm not sure you have loan commitments.
Well, because if we scope loan commitments out of it, but if we assume that we keep loan commitments out, does that mean we would keep the differential calculation for loan commitments out?
I think
the way the questions are phrased in the paper is just focusing on loan commitments or on revolving credit lines. So if we took the first question just on the scope of limiting it to revolvers, then I think the second question on discount rate should be limited to that as well, subject to the same. Okay.
And you're not taking, or you are taking, a suggestion on presentation?
I'll ask the question now.
Okay.
So can we have the hands again on the discount rate? Everybody,
Philippe is not here.
Philippe, why? And then presentation.
Yeah, and then the third question is about presentation, and I think again limited to, for now, to revolving credits, whether the presentation should be as we set it out in the exposure draft and according to the staff recommendation, or do you want to change that and show it all as a loss allowance?
Well, I think Sue suggested a slightly different to that.
Yeah, so my suggestion was that we would allow people to use a FIFO approach as a simplification.
Yeah, don't allow that stuff.
Okay.
So who's in favour of that?
FIFO.
With Sue suggestion.
Sue, yeah.
Okay. Next paper. Cool. Okay. So paper 5B, talking about financial assets at fair value OCI. This paper discusses the treatment of expected credit losses for financial assets measured at fair value OCI. I will clear up the entire paper. There is two questions, but I'll ask both at the end simultaneously. Yesterday, the board tentatively confirmed a new mandatory measurement category for eligible financial assets, namely fair value through OCI. In introducing this category, the IFB proposed in its limited amendment to IFRS 9 exposure draft that it issued in November 2012 that the information the entity produces in profit or loss should be the same for instruments measured at amortized cost and those measured at fair value through OCI, including impairment losses. This is because the contractual cash flow characteristics of financial assets at fair value through OCI would present solely payments of principal and interest being the same as assets at amortized cost. Accordingly, the exposure draft on expected credit losses proposed that the financial assets measured at fair value through OCI would apply the same general model as assets measured at amortized cost. In addition, this also addressed the one weakness identified by the Financial Crisis Advisory Group, namely, the complexity of having multiple impairment approaches. Respondents were almost unanimous in their support for including financial assets at fair value through OCI in the scope, and furthermore, the majority agreed that the general model should apply. Some respondents suggested that we include a practical expedient for these assets, being when they're in stage one, either that when certain conditions are met that we do not recognize any allowance, or we do not recognize allowances in stage one when they're immaterial. We analyze these approaches in paragraph 24 to 38. The staff does not recommend to include a practical expedient because a fair value-based practical expedient would be inconsistent with the general model that should instead consider changes in credit risk of default. It would be inconsistent with the objective to have a single impairment model for financial assets at fair value through OCI and those at amortized cost, and it would not provide the information the IFB sought to provide in the classification and measurement project. Lastly, the staff is recommending to clarify that expected credit losses reflect management's expectation of credit risk rather than the market assessments of credit risk. However, market information remains an important consideration for management in making its assessment, and management cannot merely disregard market information. On that, I open the floor for discussion.
Keogh, I'd like to know the following. I don't object on the face of what you're saying, but here's a scenario. I'd like to know how this model applies to it.
Okay.
It's the summer of 2011, and large financial institutions are holding the debt of sovereign entities that are experiencing extraordinary financial difficulties and have been so for more than several years. And the market price of their securities is tanked, well below their par value, and has been so for that period of time. How can we ensure that this model will adequately take into consideration that change in the market's assessment? And the market is saying that you should have a significant impairment loss recognized. This says that expected credit losses will reflect management's expectation of credit risk rather than the market's assessment, when management's expectations are completely unrealistic, as evidenced by the market. How do we ensure that scenario that we witnessed already doesn't recur again?
What's going on here?
I'm wondering if the board members Okay, so my perspective of how that should be happening, and this might be my true purist person believing in the good of humankind, is that the market is clearly very different from how management sees it. So we are not saying management and the market will be exactly the same, because we don't always believe you can exactly identify and value market credit risk.
Right.
But in this case, the market is telling that they disagree. And management can't just ignore that and override it and say, therefore, we think it will be good, and we ignore that market is valuing it down. Mm-hmm. They should take that into account, and for them to override
that. You put those words in the document, that management cannot ignore that information?
I think it will be part of the overall, you know, where we say you need to consider the best available information, you need to consider all the available information. So the market information is part of it. Mm-hmm. But maybe if we just give a bit of background as to why this question came up, was in hedge accounting, we said you can't separate the credit risk or the fair value changes to credit risk from the rest of the fair value changes, so you can't hedge that. And that raised the question where people said, well, on fair value OCI, what you're asking us to do is to put fair value changes other than credit risk in OCI and the rest of the fair value changes for fair value OCI through the P&L. And that is not what that's not what our model is trying to do. It's not the fair value changes related to credit risk that you need to recognize. It's management's expectation about the cash flow.
I don't disagree. But I'm talking about the disconnect here between the market's assessment of credit risk and management's assessment of credit risk. And to the extent that that difference has been other than temporary, it's persisted for long periods of time, I think this approach would allow management to continue to ignore that difference.
So I think maybe in terms of the recommendation that we make, and maybe in terms of saying, so what our job is in clarifying is to better illustrate to people the interaction then between the market assessment and their own assessment, and that we just make that clear in the drafting. Because I think Rihanna explains the one extreme case that what people reported, and I think you're showing the other extreme case. So it's just clarifying how the two relate to each other.
I think we'd say it's an important piece of information, but it's not determinative in and of itself.
After 3 years, I would say this.
But I would hope that you would have a pretty robust conversation with your auditor if you had a market price that had completely tanked and you're still saying you don't think there's anything wrong with credit.
And I think the point about it, the model does say you must take account of all information, so that's already there. I think perhaps the concern that you've got almost extends beyond listed items to also non-listed items. It was almost, it would be easier for management to make their call on non-listed because they don't have the price indicator. I think the fact that we're saying you have to use all current information means that management would have to, I would think, very stoutly defend why they think that that information is not relevant.
Well, all I've seen is very unrealistic valuations, very unrealistic allowances for losses as a result of this principle operating today. And yet, we're not addressing that issue. In fact, we're sanctioning that practice
I think that's true.
The words are right here. It says that it's management's expectation, and they do not have to consider the market's assessment any more so than any other piece of data. We don't say that they have to give priority to it.
But it doesn't say you should do less.
That's not just an issue with assets that are in OCI.
I don't disagree.
You've never raised this issue before when we discussed amortized cost category.
I have raised it consistently. Sue Lloyd will vouch for that.
Mary?
I agree with the staff's recommendation on question two, but share some of Pat's concerns. Pat's going to give some concerns about the drafting. And the suggestion I was starting to work through is to say, say something along the lines of, management can override market only if it has better information available to it. You know, something that says you got to be able to demonstrate why you know more than the marketplace.
I like that a lot.
The way it's formulated here is a bit, in passing by, well, market information needs to be taken into account.
The staff paper is too stark in terms of management always trumps, but I think it's the right
The risks there, especially with sovereign bonds, are huge. That induce, they find all sorts of reasons to ignore market information.
You just want in drafting to be
even when sovereign bonds are investment grade. I mean, that's the present situation, that a lot of the European sovereign bonds that are deteriorated beyond investment grade are not being repaired at all. That should clearly change as a result of this new standard. So I agree that the wording here is a bit stark.
And I don't want management that thinks it's from the market price you may infer a loss of 20%. If you as management have done calculations that you believe it's going to be 25%, I don't want them handcuffed to having to recognize 20% because we are requiring them to follow market. So
the examples that we've seen is that was market rate of 80%.
So I'd say right idea, but it needs some handcuffs.
Mm-hmm.
If a government bond falls from 100 to 60, this model is not going to put 40 as the impairment allowance, even if management expectations equal market expectations.
Exactly.
Is that your concern? Because this isn't going to get you to an allowance of 40.
I agree with that. My concern is more the market has been at 60 for 3 years, and management has booked an allowance of nil or one
but
or five.
That's in the profit and loss. On the balance sheet, it's at fair value. The example in the appendix fits pretty well.
I don't disagree, but profit and loss.
Yes.
Very important.
But this also demonstrates to me the fallacy in the model. I mean, in this case, the item that goes into OCI is the fair value movement minus the impairment that's being taken up in the profit and loss, which is just a plug figure. And you're going to accumulate that plug figure for a number of years until you sell or realize that asset, and then you're going to drop the plug figure down into profit and loss all in one bundle. And it's
but you're rate hitting on the eye, you really go for it.
but the issue that Steve raised also applies to amortized cost. And in your point, the fair value, the 100 minus 60 is shown in fair value, but in amortized cost, it's not shown anywhere.
Okay.
And the 40 mm-hmm. is not going to be booked because of our impairment. So
not
I think the Pat McConnell raised a point which Finnegan said, if you want to make this global thing about hitting people on their head with a mallet, which I really don't think is needed, but if you guys want to do it, you got to do it consistently both for fair value OCI and fair value or amortized cost, number one. And also, do not, if you put that caveat about fair value, don't ignore, you got to think about the 40 need cannot be an automatic booking of thing. It gets into other issues. That's why I'm not in favor of it, but if you guys want to hit somebody with a mallet, make sure that you...
The issue isn't about short-term movements. The issue is when it's persistently underwater for long periods of time.
Still, I don't know whether you will have 40.
It
won't. Even if it's persistent 3 years, it won't be 40 under the original model.
Good.
Yeah.
If it is 20, how do you distinguish between liquidity and credit? Man, that is...
Yeah.
You take an extreme example, then maybe you're making your point, but if it is in between, then...
And also
the board has said you cannot be
too good.
I'm willing to live with management's judgment in those, let's say less than a year.
And it will put a lot of pressure on the auditors with the way you're going to write it to say you've got to book 40, and that does not comport with the standard. And if you put
that's not what we suggest. Not what I'm suggesting.
Martin, I thought we have asked for this impairment standard because the existing one, which had for AFS securities, which is prolonged for a long time, 20-30% under fair value, then maybe you have an indication you're doing it. And that caused really the problems, and I think that was the reason why we said, okay, we should go away from this kind of stuff and we should have this.
Exactly.
But if we
Was it working together?
Like I said, it was not working, right. And that is why we have now a different standard. But what you said, okay, is now we need something compared to what was in the past. If it is 20-30% below fair value and is for, I don't know, 1-3 years, then you have a strong indication for impairment.
I think that would take that's a bit of a long time, isn't it?
Yeah, but you know, don't know. Maybe that is exactly the point, because the old standard has not worked, because you cannot say, okay, is it then the fair value, is it liquidity or is it credit risk? I think that the board has concluded in the hedge accounting standard. And if we stick to that, then if it is something in between and it's 20% for 1 year, you don't know. Is it impairment or is it really liquidity? You don't know that.
And you should not book the 100% difference.
Right. And yeah, what? And then, the and then what is then the consequence? Is it something in between or?
Tomorrow.
Thanks, Tom. I think much has been said, but my view is that the staff was trying to draw our attention to the importance of information asymmetry here between the management, internal risk assessment of credit risk, and external information regarding the price of the instrument itself. So when we see only to the price of the instrument outside, we are blurring not only credit risk, but also other types of risks, and we are focused here in credit risk. So that's why I agree with the staff. The general model, I think, captures the need to consider all information around, when we go to extreme examples like the one brought up by Pat, they are extreme. So under extreme situations, we have to test the model. But the model, again, is an entity-specific model, has lots of judgments, and information asymmetry plays and will play a very important role in the application of the model.
Okay. With the drafting suggestions that have been suggested, do we agree with the staff recommendation?
Yes.
Okay. Next paper. Journal?
Yep, page one.
All right. So the next paper is paper 5C, which analyzes the feedback received on the proposals for the presentation of interest revenue. The EB proposed that interest revenue generally should be calculated using the effective interest method on the gross carrying amount of a financial asset. However, for assets that have objective evidence of impairment, interest should be calculated on the net carrying amount. Also, the calculation should be symmetrical in that if there is no longer objective evidence of impairment, the calculation can move back to being on the gross carrying amount. Paper 5C is organized into three issues, which are whether the interest revenue calculation should change and to what approach, for what asset population it should change, and finally, whether it should be symmetrical. The vast majority of respondents agreed that the interest revenue calculation should change when there is objective evidence of impairment, and most thought it should change to a calculation based off the net amount. It was noted that this would help avoid the overstatement of interest revenue and also more faithfully represent the economic return. A minority of respondents preferred a non-accrual approach. The primary reason for this was operational concerns, such as having to run two different interest revenue models, and also others preferred it because it was more aligned to regulatory practices in their jurisdiction. The staff continue to think that the net interest approach is the most appropriate option to faithfully represent the economic return. And this is because it's the result of decoupling interest revenue from expected credit losses, which in turn results in the effective interest rate not being adjusted for credit loss expectations. A net approach also balances operational concerns and will result in minimal changes to practice because entities already apply this under IAS 39. Furthermore, a net approach avoids commingling the amortization of the carrying amount under the amortized cost measurement with expected credit losses, as would occur if we went to a non-accrual approach. Finally, nearly all respondents agreed that the interest revenue approach should be symmetrical, and it was noted that this ensures comparability among assets in each stage, which is important also for operational reasons. Given the strong support, as I've previously outlined, The staff recommendation is to confirm the proposals and the ED. So with that said, I'll open it to the board for any discussions or questions.
I'll disagree.
I don't disagree. I query the use of this phrase, objective evidence of impairment.
Right.
Because it kind of implies to me that at stage two, you don't have objective evidence of impairment. And I think the objective evidence of it being impaired is there in stage two as well.
Well, yeah, I understand your concern. And so we think that, and the board decided as reflected in the basis for conclusions, that objective evidence of impairment would be the best choice, mainly for the operational concerns. And so objective evidence of impairment, for example, is a bit wider than default because it takes into account a...
I don't disagree with the point at which you move from gross to net. I just don't... It's the term.
Hmm. Did he have just recalled it an incurred loss and then had the list? Is it the definition we're using?
I don't know about using the word incurred loss because I think that's misused as well.
But wasn't that something we're using in the basic impairment?
Wasn't the objective that terminology carried over from 39?
So we're using the definition of an incurred loss.
Yeah, but if somebody reads IFRS 9 that's never looked at 39 and they looked at this phrase objective evidence of impairment, it just seems...
We need to find a better descriptor for the stage 3.
I think we're happy to change the words if that's what you're concerned about.
Yeah.
I think that's a good point.
But to use the description in the same way so that they can still use have the system.
Yeah, I'm happy with what it means.
Okay. Okay. We can look at that.
Otherwise, agreement?
You should give them more papers, John.
Paper 5D, purchase or originate a credit impaired asset. This paper discusses the treatment of expected credit losses for purchase or originated credit impaired financial assets. These assets are those that have objective evidence of impairment on initial recognition. The exposure draft proposed to carry forward the existing requirements in IAS 39 for these financial assets. The ISB argued that it presented superior information, more faithfully represents the economics of these financial assets, and is consistent with the 2009 ED proposals the board has always acknowledged is the more conceptual correct approach. Respondents were almost unanimous in their support for these proposals. Although these proposals are the same as the 2009 ED, it is more operable for these financial assets as it is consistent with the treatment today in IAS 39 and would apply to a smaller population. Some respondents did, however, argue that we should adopt the gross-up approach. We discussed this approach in paragraph 12. However, we did agree that it would increase comparability. This is because for these financial assets, the purchase or credit impaired would be grossed up for the allowance, whereas with other assets, it would be net of the allowance. Furthermore, disclosures are provided to users about the initial expected credit losses. This is not the purpose of the paper to discuss these disclosures, as we will be discussing that in December. Accordingly, the staff recommends that the board carry forward the proposals in the ED on their purchase or originated credit impaired financial assets. Lastly, the staff recommends to address in drafting the request for more guidance on originated credit impaired financial assets. With that, I open the floor.
Yes, just a question in the last paragraph before the question, so paragraph 25. Say we recommend addressing the respondent's concerns for more guidance, by drafting. And I just wanted to confirm what you mean by that, and I think it's picking up some of the commentary from the IFRIC, Interpretation Committee discussion and incorporating that. And is there anything more that you're talking about, or is it basically just that?
So I think it's that, which is also a lot of the guidance that all the board used in arguments and the basis for conclusion, and it's bringing that up as guidance.
Stuff from the basis, and okay.
Because I think in our outreach, when we actually explained to people exactly that, they understood what you mean.
So why is there no 12-month allowance for purchase credit impaired? I spend $100 million buying a credit impaired portfolio and I book it at $100. Spend $100 million buying a portfolio that isn't credit impaired and I book it at $98. Why do we book a portfolio that's higher risk at a higher value.
You know the answer.
So,
for everybody, argument. So, for the purpose of reason at the creditor's case, one of the key things is we apply the creditor's adjusted yield, which was the recommendations in 2009, which in course, when you recognize interest revenue subsequently, it is already at a reduced rate and spread. Unfortunately, we couldn't apply that to the good book because that people said was too complex. And for that, it resulted in us using a higher effective interest rate, which wasn't adjusted for the credit. So from the onset, you have the situation where interest revenue is recognized as too high, and we needed to find something to adjust it, and that something ended up being the 12-month allowance after all the deliberations. And the board confirmed that approach.
Well, put another way, it's a perfect model, but this is the biggest scope that we could apply it.
Do you want to book the 12-month order for the purchase credit impaired?
If I supported it for other assets, I would.
Really?
He agrees with the staff recommendation.
Who?
Okay. Well, I think we should use the gross up method as well.
Steve disagrees, so 14.
Okay. As Dialogue mentioned, whether we can find easy terms for this method.
I have to find a new word we can use it here as well.
The simplified approach for trade receivables.
Paper 5E analyzes feedback received on the simplified approach for trade and lease receivables. It doesn't, however, discuss the disclosures for the simplified approach, which will be addressed in a future meeting. The EB proposed that entities should have an accounting policy choice to always measure the loss allowance of trade receivables and lease receivables at an amount equal to lifetime expected credit losses. The choice should be applied consistently to all such receivables, but can be applied independently to either trade or lease receivables. For trade receivables that do not constitute a financing transaction, measurement at lifetime expected credit losses is required. Additionally, the ED proposed to amend IFRS 9 to measure these trade receivables at transaction price on initial recognition rather than at fair value like all other financial assets. The vast majority of respondents agreed with the simplified approach for both trade and lease receivables. Respondents agreed that the approach would provide operational relief by alleviating some of the concerns of tracking credit risk, and this was particularly the case for non-financial entities. Though some noted that having such an accounting policy choice may have some comparability concerns, they felt that this did not outweigh the operational considerations and that the approach appropriately balanced the costs and benefits. Nearly all respondents agreed with measuring trade receivables that don't constitute a financing transaction at lifetime expected credit losses, given that there would be little or no difference between 12-month and lifetime on these due to their short duration. Furthermore, they also strongly agreed with recognizing them at transaction price at initial recognition because this both aligns us closer with the revenue recognition project and brings the initial recognition of those instruments closer to actual fair value. The staff's analysis is presented in paragraphs 17 through 31, and given the strong support, is largely a confirmation of the proposals. The one issue that we noted was for lease receivables, for which some respondents requested that they be allowed to apply different accounting policy choices to different subsets of their lease receivable population. We are, however, recommending not to address this at this time, given that the leases project is still under development. However, it's something that we recommend looking at again when that's finalized. So with that said, I'll open it to the board for any questions.
Yes, I agree with staff recommendation, but I doubt whether all the four read our proposal because they are busy for reading our ideas. Some. The one frustration I heard from the four was their risk management style is different from that of the financial institution. So their risk management style basically based on the underlying assets of the lease. So therefore, they are not very much interested in the credit quality of the lessee because they have underlying assets. But our proposal forces some of the lessor to behave like financial institutions. Of course, they have a financial element, and their activity is quite similar to financial institutions. But as I said, risk management is entirely different. So therefore, if they want to apply general model, the hurdle for them to do it is quite high compared to financial institutions. Of course, they can go to the simplified model, but the simplified model is lifetime loss on day one. And for some of the lessors, they have quite long life lease agreement. So if they were asked to recognize lifetime loss, unlike trade receivable, they have to recognize more losses. So therefore, even if they go to simplified approach, they have to recognize more. And even if they try to general approach, there is a practical hurdle. So that's why they are frustrated. And perhaps, that is my guess, perhaps they want to raise the issue that, you know, for the lease receivable, we should stay on IS30 incurred loss model rather than expected loss model. But personally, I don't think we have to take it up now. That's why I agree with staff's recommendation. But we have to take note that perhaps during the discussion in the lease project, lessor will surely come back with this frustration. So we have to take this into note. But now, for now, I agree with staff's recommendation.
I just quickly want to... I can understand if they say, you know, the simplified or... the general model is complex for them to apply. But I think if they are saying they're not interested really in the credit risk of the customer, there would be no reason for them to apply the general model. They can do the simplified one.
Even
under the simplified model, if they have to recognize lifetime losses, they will still take into account the collateral they've got against those. So
on this point, yes.
The losses, it's not, they won't be punished in the fact that they have to recognize all of the losses without taking into account the assets that they've got.
Yeah, I do understand that. However, if they have a longer duration and the residual value, there is some uncertainty on residual value of the underlying assets, so then they have a receivable. So then perhaps, you know, the best solution is for them to go to general model because it's like a long-term loan. But because of the reason, there is a hurdle. So they are,
I think in general, I agree with the recommendation. Just I want to clarify a little late leasing, just make sure we're on the same page. If for leasing, say, the ED is and this recommendation remains, you have a choice, you can full up front or you can take it over time. I don't think there's anything in between, you know, that we consider right red press. But now if you take it all up front today, I presume when this thing is finalized, assuming it finalizes as is, you would have a choice to take it over time, make an accounting principle change reflecting the new accounting event, the intention.
Right.
Or vice versa, as the case may be.
Right.
And in the part you would say defer for the leasing or wait for the leasing project, where if you have different types of lease portfolios, you might get different answers. I can think of examples where you have commercial industrial lessors that also have a separate line of business doing the equivalent of, you know, not asset-based lending, but, you know, you know, direct financing, lease lending, you know, for just a separate business, you can make an argument, I would say, for those lease sales type leases in support of your commercial business, you get full up front, but for your part of your business that operates like a bank and can take it over time, I think. I mean, I can see a lot of arguments for that that's a good thing, but for right now it would be until all or nothing is how you're looking at it, correct?
That's right.
Now, would you take this up in this project or in the leasing project? I mean, what if the leasing project took a long time to finish? You know, would you go, when would you plan to go back to this?
Well, I think that would come in as a steep issue at a later point.
For this project or the leasing project?
Yes.
For the leasing project. Because we'll have to wait until we know what the lessor model is that the impairment's being applied to. So I think we'll need to bring the principles of this project back and sort of confirm how they've been applied to the leasing project later on.
That just means we want to finish this project.
Yeah.
Presumably we're closer to finishing this one than we are leasing. Well, hope so too. No, but the point is we just sort of go with this and readdress this in the later in the leasing project sometime down the line.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and I agree with that.
So end up perhaps a consequential amendment.
I agree with staff. With regards to Taka's point, I do understand, of course, your concern, but the same is valid for a large population of lessors that are financial institutions already as well. So for them, they have. I think we are achieving the right balance, providing an accounting policy for all lessors. So I believe we are in the right path here.
And that's why the staff, what the staff originally analyzed when the board decided to include lease receivables under the expected credit loss model, it was noted that lease receivables themselves are quite similar to other financial assets at amortized cost. And so there is the operational concern, of course, but that's what we try to mitigate with a simplified approach.
I would probably just add to my former life in the preparers communities I was on, that this effect, I can assure you, if you had leasing as part of your commercial business operations, they were following this project.
This is unrelated to Lisa's question. In the run-up to the IFRS 9 on this issue about trade receivables, we made two changes. Change one is that for the trade receivables with financing, we said transaction price should be the starting point rather than fair value. And the second is this concession we have made, and I have no objection to that. I want to ask you if there is a potential for effective date different from IFRS 9, because this language is not in the existing IFRS 9. And if revenue standard goes according to plan, it's going to hit the streets pretty soon. I want to ask you, how do we intend to bridge that gap that is existing temporarily for a period of time? Because right now the IFRS 9 says it's fair value, and the revenue recognition says go and look at the IFRS 9 how to do the receivables. I'll admit that I read this staff draft on the revenue already. So there is this fear, how do we do this? Because otherwise, this whole fight we had, start with transaction price and recognize the bad debt, the whole discussion will be inconsistently applied, because some people will take a fair value, some people will take transaction price, and some people will do it. I don't know how to plug this gap between the two, but there is a gap.
The question is really, do we need to do something in 39 in the interim?
Yes. Either in 39 or an existing IFRS 9, do something in interim, because I think waiting for this would be a time delay.
You could put it in the existing IFRS 9, but it's not much use unless you've actually applied IFRS 9, it won't kick in. So you might need to.
I would put it in 39, that would be my preference, because we need to think about it. We don't want to think about it now, that's fine, but I really think there is a time difference.
So I don't agree with the staff recommendation. I don't like choices, so having this accounting policy choice is disliked, even more so when neither of the choices reflect the economics. So having a lifetime loss creates double counting that we've complained about so much when Bousby has proposed a lifetime loss for banking. So I don't see how we could recommend it for this. And having the 12-month allowance, its significant finance component doesn't quite double count, but it nearly double counts in many cases. So I don't like either of them. Of course, what we've got is the wrong discount rate in revenue recognition. If you have a discount rate in revenue recognition that didn't reflect credit risk, but we put a discount rate in revenue recognition that does, so then putting the credit losses in here just double counts. My solution would be not to have the 12-month allowance for trade receivables, because the credit deterioration inherent in moving to stage two is not dissimilar to where we are now, and I'm not sure what problem we're trying to fix with trade receivables.
So what is your solution?
My solution would be to not have the 12-month allowance, not give the choice. Say you account for trade receivables by assessing deterioration. I don't think that's a million miles away from the matrix approach that we currently have for incurred loss, and not have the 12-month allowance. I'm not sure what problem we're trying to fix for trade receivables. Obviously, I'm talking about those with a significant financing component. If it isn't, clearly the lifetime allowance is right to get back to fair value. It's where there's a significant financing component.
If the trade receivable is 5 years, BMW Finance, would you still think that that would be treated differently?
I think, yes. Yeah. Well, of course, I think that a five-year loan, bank loan, should be treated differently from the way it's described as well. But
say that given where the bank loans are, would you want a five-year finance deal as part of a purchase of a Volvo to be treated differently to bank loans?
That would be five-year credit.
Yes, I would.
Can I ask a question of the staff? Is this issue further compounded, the one that Stephen has identified, which I'm empathetic to, by the last decision that we made about introducing a collectability threshold?
No.
I mean, you're further taking into consideration in the determination of that transaction price the effects of credit.
You've recognized nothing, so there's no receivable to...
We did speak to the revenue team on that to make sure there wasn't an issue, but there isn't. So, since you have addressed
economically, that. I'm not sure I agree with you. Perhaps from an accounting standpoint.
Who agrees with the staff recommendation?
It's too big. 13.
Okay, then the final paper.
The mandatory effective date of 5/9. This paper does not discuss the mandatory effective date. Instead, it is only meant to provide the market a signal with when the standard would not be effective. So, at the July meeting, the IFC noted that it will not be able to determine a mandatory effective date for IFRS 9 until finalization of both the impairment and the classification and measurement requirements. In publishing the new hedge accounting requirements on Tuesday, the board also removed the effective date of 1 January 2015. Respondents have asked clarity on the potential effective date of IFRS 9. The paper considers the arguments put forth by the respondents and the lead time required to implement the completed standard, with a focus on expected credit losses. The paper presents the minimum time period the staff considers would be appropriate to implement the completed IFRS 9, taking into account the current proposed completion of IFRS 9 in the first half of 2014. The staff recommends that a mandatory effective date not be earlier than the 1st of January 2017 to ensure robust implementation of the new standard. The date is based on the completion of IFRS 9 in the first half of 2014. Alternatively, the board can recommend a mandatory effective date not earlier than 2 to 3 years after publishing the completed IFRS 9. With that, I open the floor.
I certainly hope it would also not be later than the 1st of January 2017. I think we should do everything we can to achieve that. Doug?
I appreciate staff's recommendation, but I don't think staff's recommendation is enough. I mean, perhaps we'd better say that we will take 3 years after publication. Yeah, but the reason why I'm saying is that financial institutions are still maintaining their project team to cope with IFRS 9. Mm. But to keep the project team is very costly. So if they could dissolve their project team
that would be fine. But once you dissolve the project team, it may take time to restart it. So therefore, they would like to know what is the kind of period of calm. So if they know how many years would be the period of calm, then they can decide to dissolve their project team. So then what we could do is we will have 3 years after publishing the final draft, then they can decide to dissolve their project team so that they are free from the heavy budget.
Mary?
I disagree with Tak. I think, first of all, looking through some of the comments that we've had about this, understand the need for a period of time between publication and adoption. I think we should be focusing on the 2 years that the staff talked about. I think in the context of the whole of IFRS 9, I can understand the significance of the changes for impairment. It's not that the others are easy, but I can see impairment really being a challenge for financial institutions. I hope that we are close to finalizing that. I don't think the clock starts from, once we finalize this piece, I don't think the clock starts from 2 years from the date you publish the last, piece of IFRS 9. We hopefully will have this out and people can start working, the project teams, on what we published about impairment. Depending upon the timing, I think we'll have to be sensitive, but I think we should be looking at a period of time, and I think we should be focusing more on 2 years.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's a mistake to take a decision or indicate a decision like this when not needed. I don't see really... We have a bad habit of making pronouncements like this, and then we change it, and then we change it, and then we change it. We are rather close, at least I hope so, of finalizing this. And if we don't pronounce anything more now than saying that we have a lot of respect for the complexity of this and we will thoroughly analyze that we can make this change over in an orderly manner, I think that is enough. And then 3 or 4 months from now, 5 months from now, we can then come back and say this is what will be. We have had so many slips on these time schedules, so I think it's a mistake really to pronounce anything now. But it's not needed.
Can I maybe interject before just the other two? In terms of saying the need that we need it and listening to the comments of 3 years and 2 years on the project, I think what has driven the need for this paper, and this is why I think it's very important that we're emphasizing it is not giving an effective date, it's saying when it's not, is that when we remove the effective date being 1 January 2015, the question almost immediately after that became, so are you saying it is 2016? And I think having looked at comments and having heard board members in separate meetings and all of that, I think we are trying to say it will not be 2016 with the comments that we received. And that is all the paper is trying to do, is say that we do not think if we finish in the first half of 2014, that 2016 can be a date.
And if I could just add to that, because I think that people are uncertain about whether we're intending 2016 at the moment. And I think for the big banks, for them to be prepared for 2016, they need basically to be starting to put in place models and teams now.
Yes, it is.
And they are concerned about doing that on the basis of board papers, staff papers, listening to board meetings, not knowing what the exact words are, and then having to go back and redo costs, redo systems changes. And if we could give them comfort that we weren't thinking of 16, it takes the pressure off them having to do that from the 1st of January, and that's really what they're asking.
Who agrees with giving up
the question? What does the timeline look like to finish this thing? I mean, you get disclosure next month.
Say it so I get blamed, Rihanna.
Our target
at the moment is that we'll finish the deliberations on the impairment model in January. And we're then targeting publication of the final IFRS 9, including classification, measurement, and impairment, in the first half of next year. So we're hoping to have the complete model
in January, but people need to see really the final words before they can really do their final system.
We would publish impairment and seeing them together?
That's our current plan, rather than having more phases coming up.
So I think what the YAM did actually is not 15 parts. It's where that we should clearly say that what can they, you know, the mandatory effective date no earlier than November,
January
2017 should be so, you know, specific to on this part.
Well, it's not very specific, it's just that no earlier than. Doesn't say it will be 1st of January 2017, although I think
that it's a debate about whether we should phrase it as won't be as early as January 2016 and whether that meant something different.
Right, so that's what we mean.
But why don't we express it more positively? We're saying, okay, we are planning really to S to Z in the next half year to finalize it, and then the board thinks, okay, that preparers need between 2 and 3 years to implement it. And then all message is out, but it's a more positive way. Like Jan has
said. That's why this can take a long time for us discussing this, because this apparently is a trivial question and it's not, the implementation date. We have to consider that this is going to be applied in a myriad of different types of entities, not only financial institutions. Of course, if you think in financial institutions, they are more likely to have this settled in a shorter period of time, although they are indicating they need 2 to 3 years. So when we start discussing this with the staff, I was against indicating, because I said, well, this is our decision. Why we are going to provide an advance notice on our intention before finishing the project? If we are finishing in a short period of time, is this in some sense also impose on us some discipline to finish this as soon as possible, because we do know the world is waiting for us. So, but at the end of the day, I was convinced by the staff arguments and the feedback we received that they need some indications. And I'm really not bothering in providing an indication that is not being, it's not expected to be earlier than 1st of January 2017, because this is my sense that the natural period that they will need. And we do need, as stressed here in our due process committee, we do need a time for systems and to have the application of the IFRS observing the new requirements with the quality and soundness that we expect to have in this new system. So I think it's quite appropriate. I think it's fair to provide some indication for this guy. And at the end of the day, the decision will be ours.
When will we decide the date?
January.
In January, but people are trying to finalize their budgets for next year at the moment.
All right. 2 months.
Yeah.
Okay, let's... can we agree with the staff recommendation?
Yes.